The Senate will please come to order. Roll call.
Roll call for Friday, January 30th. Anderson District 2.
Aye.
Anderson District 28.
Here.
Barnard.
Here.
Bebout.
Here.
Burns.
Here.
Case.
Present.
Christensen. Christensen.
Excused. Here.
Christensen present. Co.
Here.
Cooper.
Here.
Kraft.
Here.
Dockstetter.
Here.
Driscoll.
Here.
Emmerich.
Here.
Escobel.
Here.
Geis.
Here.
Hastert.
Here.
Hicks.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Kinski.
Here.
Landon.
Here.
Meyer.
Here.
Pappas.
Here.
Perkins. Peterson,
here.
Roth,
here.
Rothfuss,
here.
Scott,
here.
Von Platern,
here.
Wasserberger,
here.
President Nicholas.
Here.
30 present.
The pastor this morning is Reverend Gilbert. Go ahead and remain seated. And I think he'd like to have the privilege of the floor first. Reverend Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Am I on?
I am. We receive a letter, and we need to sign that in returning it to legislative office so that we have the privilege of prayer. And in that letter are these words. Please keep in mind that the Senate is comprised of members of many different faith traditions. I try to honor that. I was privileged to teach world religions at LCCC, and for me it was a time of information and formation. And during that time, I visited my sister in New Jersey, and I drove by a Hindu temple. The parking lot was filled with cars. I stopped and I walked inside, and a young man came up and introduced himself. You probably could tell I was a stranger, and told me what was going on in front of the sanctuary, if it be, were images of Krishna, Vishnu, and Shiva. And he said that they were preparing to celebrate Shiva. And he called an older gentleman over who told me more about what they were doing. And then this gentleman said, "Would you like for me to pray?" I was caught off guard, and I said, "Thank you, but no thank you." He went on to tell us some more and then went back to what he was doing. And I asked the young man, I said, "Had he prayed, what would he have prayed?" And he said, "Well, probably he would have prayed for your health, that you would prosper in your work. And then he would have prayed for the well-being of your family." To this day, I wish I would have said yes rather than no, because had I said yes, I would have been able to reach across and bridge the barriers, but I allowed those barriers to stand. I share that story because I wish to conclude our prayer with a traditional Christian Trinitarian benediction, and I hope you receive it as a blessing. May we pray. In the Genesis story of creation, we read that you, O God, finished the work you had done, and you rested on the seventh day. This week we have designed and debated bills. We have listened to constituents, companion senators, and our own understanding. We have voted. We are doing our work and look forward to a day of rest. As we rest, grant us clear insight to reflect upon the work we have done. As we rest, renew us in body, mind, and spirit for the week and the work ahead. As we rest, may we be blessed with penetrating wisdom to see beneath the surface and understand the substance that forms solid foundations for life. Grant safety in travel and sweet reunions with loved ones. And now may the love of God, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us now and always. Amen.
Amen. Please join me with the pledge. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Is this your last week with us? Good deal. You know, we sure enjoyed having you. Oh, I'll get you just a minute. Pastor Gilbert, thank you for being with us this week. We really appreciate it. And we do have a coin that we'd like to give you, just a reminder and a thanks. I know you've been here before, and maybe you have these coins. If you do, then you can hand them out to others. But thank you for being with us this week. Appreciate it. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And our doctor today is Dr. Kaiser from MD from Cheyenne, not from MD, but we know if you give him a warm welcome. Today in Wyoming history, in 1912, a coal mine explosion in Kemmer killed five. Just a reminder of what we do here. And session status, today is the 14th day of the proposed 37-day session. Next Friday, a week from today, is the last day for bills to be reported out of committee in the House of Origin. Just a reminder. Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, if I may have privilege of the floor.
You may.
Mr. President, I'd like to tell you a little bit of a story about the good Reverend Richard Gilbert. You know, one of the things that we have the luxury of down here in the Senate and the legislature is it broadens our horizon and the people that we get to meet and those relationships. Well, because of my opportunity to serve the people in the Wyoming, I've got to know the Reverend, not from a standpoint of his current retired occupation as Reverend, but through our affiliation here. He's also a very good writer. He writes for a number of magazines. Historically, he's published articles in the Wyoming Wildlife magazine. And I have two of his photographs hanging in my office because he did an article about some wetland project for Wyoming Wildlife magazine here in the state of Wyoming in my district. So it's always a pleasure to meet people like Reverend Gilbert. But look for those opportunities, they exist. So, again, he's also a very good wildlife photographer and writer. So, thank you, Mr. President.
We enjoyed having you. Thank you.
I paid for that.
He says he paid for all that advertising. Representative Landon.
Mr. President, may I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
You know, a lot of times we stand up and clap, but I hope that our healthcare professionals know that we don't take them for granted. And I'm walking proof by the end of this week that they really do save lives. So I wanted to especially thank our doctors, and I know they've saved about five of us in the last 2 weeks here in the Senate. So I just wanted them to know they make a difference. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. And at this time, I think Senator Hastert would like to have privilege of the floor.
Members of the Senate, with me over here today, I'm going to start with Christopher Shedd. He is with Western Wyoming Community College, the marketing director. And with him, he brings, stay standing. With him, he brings Andrea Sanchez-Walk. She is a 4.0 pre-med major She was selected by the Wyoming Community College Trustee Association as Student of the Year, and with her is her husband, Caden. I'd like to welcome them to the Senate. Andrea, I think Andrea would like to say a couple words to the Senate, if you may.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you.
Why don't you pull that mic to just pull it down a little closer to you? There.
Sorry.
You go.
Okay. Thank you, Senator, and thank you all for letting me be here today. It's a privilege to earn this award. I worked really hard, and my parents did a lot for me, traveled a lot so that I can get the best education in Wyoming. I feel proud to say that, you know, I'm a Wyoming resident, and I lived here pretty much my whole life, and I can't tell you enough how great of an education I got here, and it means so much, you know? And thank you guys again for letting me be here today. I'm sorry, I'm kind of nervous. And
you're doing a good job.
So, pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, and today's the. You want to do the journal before? We should have done that before our new business. Reading the journal. Will the reading clerk please read the journal committee report?
Mr. President, your journal committee reports that the journal of January 29, 2015 has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Jeff Wasserberger, chairman.
Without any objections, the journal committee report is adopted. The last thing before we get started this morning is this is the last day that we'll have Nicholas here. He was he's going to head back home and study. And Nicholas, we do have a proclamation for you. Why don't you come on over to the microphone and I'll meet you over here.
So, not so fast.
Oh, you're just getting ready, huh? Well, Nicholas, we liked having you here. When Nicholas started out, there is a program to pay pages, and so we're going to pay him. Turns out, he's too young, can't be paid. So anyway, everybody knows that Burns gives these $2 bills. That's your pay for the week. When you see Senator Burns, thank him for the $2. We do have this cool coin for you. We're glad to have you. And we have this proclamation just giving you our thanks and has all of our signatures on that one day will become really valuable to you. But, Nicholas, we've enjoyed having you, and we enjoy remembering your grandfather this week. And every time we think about it, a smile comes to our face. And let me see, you want me to read your notes here?
I can read it.
Oh, you can do it.
I just wanted to thank everyone for letting me be here. It was fun. I enjoyed learning about the system and hearing the debates, although sometimes they were a bit long. But yeah, everyone was really nice and the food was really good. So, a lot better than school lunch. But yeah, just thank you.
Thank you. Reports from standing committees.
January 30th, 2015, Mr. President.
It wasn't the full $2, I know.
Mr. President, your committee number one judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 132, Wyoming Fair Housing Act, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinsey, Von Fladeren, Senator Christensen, Chairman. January the 29th, 2015, Mr. President, Committee Number 12, Rules and Procedures, to whom was referred Senate File 116, Legislative Compensation. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Kraft, Nicholas, Perkins, and Rothfuss, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. January the 29th, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 5, Agricultural, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 126, Water Quality. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Christensen, Dockstader, Emmerich, and Geis. Senator Emmerich, Vice Chairman. January the 30th, 2015, Mr. President, Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 62, Oral Chemotherapy Parity. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Are there any other messages from the House, or none? Are we ready to do? Senator Wasberger, are you just gazing, or would you like the President's floor?
Is it an appropriate task for privilege of the floor?
You can have the privilege of the floor.
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. President, I would like to introduce to the body former Senator Raylan Jobe and Mary Garland L. Bogan in the lobby. Please stand up and be recognized. Welcome to the Senate.
Hey.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. May I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just a heads up for the senators, and we're going to get an official thing out on this for you to have, but on the scheduling for the supplemental budget bill, the plan right now is to, as you know, with the last day of Committee of the Whole in the House of Origin is the 9th of February, then the last day of second reading, the 10th, and, of course, third reading in the original House will be on the 11th. And, Mr. President, what we're going to do is we're going to start Committee of the Whole discussion on the supplemental budget bill on the 11th. And if we need to continue, we'll continue over to the 12th. And then we will be not here, unless you want to stay and work in the Capitol. I'm sure the lights will be on, the 14th or the 16th. And then we will start second reading amendment on the 17th of your supplemental budget bill. Take off the 18th, have third reading and final passage of that on the 19th, and hopefully get it off to the governor. I mean, start Joint Conference Committee reports and discussion on the 20th, and then send that bill to the governor on the 26th. The significance of this is that if you want second reading amendments on the supplemental budget bill, they have to be done by the 12th at 6 p.m. That's in our rules. I'll be glad to answer any questions. Otherwise, Mr. President, we will get a more formal one out so you can follow, but that's a consensus of where we're going on our scheduling.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floater. When he says the 12th, that means the Thursday before you leave the four-day weekend. So you have to have your amendments in before you leave for the weekend. We're at that order of business. Bills on second reading. Senate File 41, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 41, Employee Online Privacy.
Excuse me. There are no amendments, no discussion. Senate File 41 having been read two separate times. The question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 50, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 50, Tribal Liaisons.
Senate File 50, being no discussion or amendments, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time, hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 93, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 93, County Road Fund Pavement Management.
No discussions or amendments. Senate File 93. Having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 99, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 99, Wyoming Pharmacy Act Amendments.
Senate File 99, no comments or amendments. Having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 105, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 105, Game and Fish Roundup Program.
There are no amendments, no discussions. Senate File 105, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 117, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 117, Air Quality Construction Permitting.
There are no amendments, no discussion. Senate File 117, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. We're now at that order of business of bills on third reading. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have a consent list?
Mr. President, we do have a consent list, and I would move third reading consent list, which is as follows. Senate File 35, Security Breach Notification. Senate File 36, Personal Identifying Information, Definitions. Senate File 73, Forcible Entry and Detainer Amendments. Senate File 75, Child Support Enforcement Amendments. Senate File 77, Ignition Interlock Licensing License Amendments. Senate File 80, Trespassing to Collect Data, Civil Cause of Action. Senate File 91, Charter School Eligibility, Bonus Payments. And Senate File 119, Hospice Respite Care.
You know, do you have a list? Do you have your list? Because my list is a little bit different. Would any of the members like any of the bills removed from the consent list? Having been read three separate times, the question is, shall these bills pass the Senate? Senate File 35, Security Branch Notification. Senate File 36, Personal Identifying Information Definitions. Senate File 73, Forcible Entry and Detainer Amendments. Senate File 75, Child Support Enforcement Amendments. Senate File 77, Ignition Interlock License Amendments. Senate File 80, Trespassing to Collect Data, Civil Cause of Action. Senate File 91, Charter School Eligibility Bonus Payments. And Senate File 119, Hospice Respite Care. Senator Anderson.
Senate File 56.
No, Senate File, I did not read it, and Senate File 56 is not on the consent list.
Okay.
The clerk will please read the roll, call the roll.
On the consent list, Anderson District 2.
Aye.
Anderson District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen. Coe,
aye.
Cooper,
aye.
Kraft,
aye.
Dockstader,
aye.
Driscoll,
aye.
Emmerich,
aye.
Escobel,
aye.
Geis,
aye.
Hastert,
aye.
Hicks,
aye.
Johnson,
aye.
Kinski,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Meyer,
aye.
Pappas.
Aye.
Perkins.
Aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Rothfuss.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Von Platern.
Aye.
Wasserberger.
Aye.
President Nicholas.
Aye.
On the consent list, 30-I. Senate File 35, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 35, 30-I. Senate File 36, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 36, 30-I. Senate File 73, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 73, 30-I. Senate File 75, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 75, 30-I. Senate File 77, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 77, 30-I. Senate File 80, are there any changes?
Scott, no.
Scott, I to no.
Case, I to no.
Case, I to no. Hastert, I to no. Escobel. Aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 80, 26 aye, 4 no. Senate File 91, are there any changes? Case aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 91. 29 aye, 1 no. Senate File 119. Are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 119. 30 aye.
Having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 35, 36, 73, 75, 77, 80, 91, and 119 have passed the Senate. Senate File 56, third reading of the bill.
Senate File 56, study on transfer of public lands, sponsored by the Natural Resource Management Committee. Be it enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
We have an amendment. Would the reading clerk please read in the amendment?
Senate File 56, third reading amendment number 1, page 1, line 13.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move third reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 56 and ask for your favorable consideration. Members of the Senate, this is just one that kind of bugged me since committee, and I should have probably brought it up on second reading. One of the things that was testified in committee was that the question was asked whether the feds had If there was any discussion and any agreement on whether the feds would agree to us managing federal lands, and or, you know, and the answer that came back was no, and there was no discussion. And so it just kind of, like I said, one of those things that I was concerned about. And what the amendment does is just simply say, before we spend $100,000 and don't even know if the feds are receptive to us managing lands instead of the transfer of lands, that we know that there we have, you know, the statutory authority, and that there's that there is some kind of that. Now, I know the discussion will be whether, and I know some of the discussion is that, well, that's part of what was found in the, will be found in the study, but I just, you know, before we spend $100,000, I just thought we should know if there's any, if they have any reception of doing that. And then the second part of it is just simply going back to the 2017, it just seemed like a very short time for something this important.
Discussion on the amendment. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President, and on and against the amendment. And the first thing, I want to thank my colleague from Sweetwater County for bringing this to our attention before he brought it on third reading. That's the protocol of the Senate. Thank you for doing that. I appreciate that. And to the first part of it, about asking that we shall determine statutory authority to consider an agreement with the state of Wyoming, and the whole purpose of that, as my colleague just stated, was to get into this and determine what that may or may not be. And quite frankly, Mr. President, there's so many ambiguous things going on with the agencies out there. Before, I'd like to get in a long, drawn-out, complicated discussion with them about whether or not they have the authority. And quite frankly, let's don't forget that what's going on in Washington today is that it doesn't really make any difference whether they have the authority or not. They do by rule what they want anyway. And so why would we want to go back there and try to ask if they have the authority when they're going to do what they want to do, as they have to us in many issues relative to EPA and so on and so forth? I won't get into that. I guess I just did, Mr. President. But I would ask that you defeat this part of the amendment. As to the second part, you know, I think that by holding the feet to the fire a little bit and trying to get this done by next year, now this isn't 15, this is 16, but we ought to continue to do that. And certainly if we find out if this bill does pass both bodies and become law and we have the money there, let's talk about that during the next budget session. If we need to extend it, we sure can. So I would ask the body to defeat this amendment with both provisions.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. On the first part of the amendment, Mr. Chair, first of all, I'll acknowledge that the sponsor did come talk to me in regard to the third reading amendment, so I appreciate that bit of courtesy. I'll simply say in regard to discussions and whatnot on the committee, as I look at this amendment, it really predetermines an outcome of what we anticipate of being an impartial committee. So the idea being this illustrates one of the exact points that we would hope to determine through this impartial study. In regard to the funding, you know, we can do several things with money, and we do a lot of it here. We can spend it, and we can save it, and sometimes we're criticized for that, or investment. I'd simply say the $100,000 in this bill is, in fact, an investment with an anticipated return and one that will help us make a sound decision on in the future. Again, I would urge your resistance to this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. President.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. President. On for the amendment, I don't think it's a full determination that we're talking about in this particular amendment. It's the idea of whether the state lands an investment is concluding that there's a determination that federal land management agencies have statutory authority to consider an agreement with the state of Wyoming. In other words, whether the agency that's being requested to do this full $100,000 study feels that there's a justification to do that study. I don't think that's a particularly high bar. I think it would be reasonable, and I am concerned about spending $100,000 when there's no determination by the agencies that have oversight over this as to whether or not there would be any possibility of an outcome. So it's simply a good first hurdle that is reasonable to get through before moving forward. So I hope the body would support this amendment.
On the amendment, discussion? The question having been called for, the Senator Scott.
Mr. President, parliamentary inquiry, the second part of the amendment has to do with the appropriation, and I've been unable to track. Is it taking money in or out such we need a roll call under the Senate rules?
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, I'll use my second time. All we're talking about on the on page 5, line 2, is the date, and it doesn't have any effect on the appropriation. That would stay the same.
There being no approach, no effect on the appropriation, the question is, third reading amendment number 1, should the Senate adopt it? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The amendment has failed. Division having been called for. Senator wanted some exercise. Everybody, all those? I think it's been called for. All those in favor of the amendment, please stand. Yeah, well. No. Yeah, well, all those who called for that division? This morning we were talking about pouring salt on the wound. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry about that. It shouldn't have been funny, I know, but it was. The amendment was adopted. We're back on the bill.
Point of order.
Oh, it should have been. The amendment failed. The amendment, I lost my composure. But one thing about it, there are plenty of people out there to make sure I didn't make a mistake. The amendment failed. We're back on the bill. Is there any discussion on the bill? The Senate File 56, having been read 3 separate times, the question is, shall the bill pass? The Chief Clerk will please call the roll.
Mr. Vice President.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case. Christensen, Coe, Cooper, Kraft, Dockstetter, Driscoll, Emmerich, Escobel, Geis, Hastert, Hicks, Johnson, Kinski, Landon, Meyer, Pappas,
aye.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Rothfuss,
no.
Scott,
aye.
Von Fladern,
aye.
Wasserberger,
aye.
President Nicholas,
aye.
Closing vote closed. 26 aye, 4 no.
Senate File 56, having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members of the elected Senate, Senate File 56 has passed the Senate.
Mr. President, during the
Senator Kinski, you may have the floor.
It's my privilege to introduce in the gallery immediately above our esteemed president, Nicole Sinque, the Assistant Director of Human Resources at the City of Sheridan, and her boss, my former co-worker, Heather Doak, the Director of Human Resources, if you ladies could stand. In the North Gallery, we have School District Number 2 trustees, Hollis Hackman and Molly Steele, and former Director of the Wyoming State Girls School, Clark Fairbank, who got lured away to the Razor City. Molly evidently slipped away, but please welcome them to the Wyoming Senate.
Senate File 98, third reading of the bill.
Senate File 98, School Athletic Safety, sponsored by Senator Landon. Be it enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
Senate File 98 has an amendment. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move.
Could we please have the amendment right in.
Thank you.
Senate File 98, third reading, amendment number 1, page 1, line 1.
Thank you. I apologize. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move third reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 98. And fellow senators, I really don't feel like we need to spend a whole lot of time going back over this bill. We've had some great conversation. There have been efforts to make sure that we get this language right. You'll recall that what we're trying to do is to afford a little bit of additional protection out there for our school districts, for our High School Activities Association, and for our coaches who are implementing some of the most rigorous standards that there are across the country. I can submit to you that there's work going on every day to protect our student athletes out there. And so what we were trying to do is strike a balance and give some added protection to our folks because we know that there are these big civil lawsuits that are coming down the pike and potentially could hit our state. And so with the help of some of our leaders in this body, which I really appreciate, Mr. President, we have come up with language that we think is going to work. We think it makes the bill stronger. You can see where it tracks in on pages 1 and 2. I don't think we need to spend a lot more time. I think the bill is ready, and I would encourage an aye vote. Thank you, Mr. President.
Discussion on the amendment? There being none, the question is, shall the Senate adopt third reading amendment number 1? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Is there any discussion on the bill? Senator Landon.
Mr. President, that essentially is the bill now. We have removed the language on page 2 and replaced it with what we think is better language. And I commend you to the bill. I think it's ready to go. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion? There being none. Senate File 98 having been read 3 separate times, the question is, shall the bill pass? The chief clerk will please call the roll.
Anderson District 2?
Aye.
Anderson District 28?
Aye.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Kraft?
No.
Dockstetter? Driscoll?
No.
Emmerich?
No.
Escobel?
No.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
No.
Hicks?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Kinski?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
Aye.
Perkins? Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
No.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Platern?
Aye.
Wasserberger?
No.
President Nicholas?
Aye.
Closing vote? Christensen, no to aye.
Driscoll,
no to aye. Closing vote? Closing vote closed. 21 aye, 9 no.
Senate File 98, having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members of the elected Senate, Senate File 98 has passed the Senate. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
President, I move that the Senate resolve itself in the Committee of the Whole to discuss the two bills on general file. And Mr. President, it's the intention of the Floor Leader to try to, if we can, work through 129. If we go a little late in lunch, we'll work through that and to get us out of here. If not, we'll recess for a little bit and come back and work through the afternoon. We're going to do whatever we need to do to give that bill full consideration.
Thank you. You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion's been adopted. Senator Bernard.
Committee of the Whole, come to order. First bill for our consideration is Senate File 111. Reading clerk will read in the bill.
Senate File 111, Summary Probate Proceeding, sponsored by Senator Perkins. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, and Von Platern, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senators, you've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 111. There is a substitute number one for File 111, and I move that substitute number one do pass.
Has to be read in.
That's right.
Reading clerk will read in the amendment.
Senate File 111, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, that substitute number 1 be substituted for Senate File 111, and that substitute number 1 do pass.
Mr. Chairman, there are standing committee amendments. Excuse me, there are amendments. I'd have that the reading clerk read in the amendments, and I'd move the amendments. That'd be Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Reading clerk will read the amendment.
We need to have him move the first one.
Did I mess it up?
Standing committee, committee of this, standing committee amendment number one has been read in. Have you moved that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that Senator Perkins explain the bill, the amendments.
Senator Perkins.
The substitute bill, which is Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, has been moved. At this time, I'd ask that we'll explain the bill, but at this point, it's probably appropriate, Mr. Chairman, that we call for the vote on the substitute bill.
There's been a question.
All those who are in favor of Senator Christensen's motion to have Senate File Number 1 approved, would you say yes? Aye.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Senator Perkins.
Okay, motion is passed, I take it, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, what we've got before you today with substitute bill and thanks to the Judiciary Committee for their assistance with the bill. After we had filed the initial bill, had been pre-filed, we had several respondents from various practitioners around the state that came up and had a lot of good ideas. We went through those with the Judiciary Committee, and with those were incorporated into the bill, and we just thought it would be Judiciary Committee thought it would be appropriate and easier to understand if it was a substitute bill coming out of the committee. I'll dispense. I understand that Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 has also been moved. At this time, I'll explain that really quick, and then I'll explain the whole bill. Substitute bill, the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 simply found some redundancy in the bill with respect to venue, and so these provisions appear.
I don't think the Committee of the Whole bill has been read in.
Is that not? Okay, at this time, I'd go ahead and move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 111, then we'll move into the bill. Okay. Thank you. So anyway, now I have moved to Standing Committee Amendment Number Whole. They're off to a great start today, aren't we? Standing Committee Amendment Number of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 111 and ask the body's favorable consideration. As explaining, we just found some redundancy in here. If you look at the bill, you'll find on page 4, lines 1 through 7, it appears in two places, and all this does is remove the redundancy. And so with that, and then I'll explain the entire bill, but if we move on that, I think it'll just take care of it, then we'll move into the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Senators, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Bill Number 1, would you please say aye?
Aye.
Those opposed? Discussion?
Thank you.
That bill has passed.
No,
amendment has passed. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So now into the bill. What we have here is in Wyoming, we've had for some time summary probate proceedings, and this bill attempts to recognize and provide some opportunity for the state to have this administered equally and consistently across the state. Practitioners have found that we're having some different results and some different interpretations of the existing law in different districts around the state, and so this bill helps to kind of modernize that and clarify some of the issues that have arisen in the various districts as judges look at the existing law. By explanation, Mr. Chairman, what this bill does, and I'm going to try and be quick because I know that this is just the cartoon to the actual the real proceeding today. But anyway, when you do this, this bill deals with, and the statute deals with, two things that happen in summary probate. First of all, if you're only dealing with personal property as opposed to real estate and real property, you're only dealing with personal property, which are things and bank accounts, things like that. You generally, if the value of the estate is under $200,000 inside the state, you can deal with that with just some amendments or just an affidavit. And you file those not in court, but with the clerk of the county clerk. And once you file those and present those, you do that, and so that then takes care of that. And that's really all that you have to do with respect to a physical procedure to deal with that property. And so the other one has to do with real property, when there's real property involved, or there are certain issues that are complicated issues that arise with personal property. Then there's a procedure which you go to court. And so this divides and separates those into two separate things. So actually, explaining the bill, if you go with me to page 5, which is where we're amending existing law, we're going to deal with that affidavit provision first. And so in explaining the bill, if you turn to page 5 and look at some changes to the existing statute of 21 of 2-1-201, which starts on line 4 of page 5. And here what we're doing is we're just moving, we're changing a couple things in the existing affidavit requirements. What we're doing is we're allowing a single distributee, which is the person who's going to receive the property under the will or under the, if there's no will, under the intestacy laws, we're allowing a single distributee to now represent and go on behalf of all other distributees. Where before you always had to have all distributees sign the affidavit, now we're allowing one distributee to do it on behalf of all distributees. That's particularly important because sometimes there are missing individuals. You can't find, people are unknown, their whereabouts are unknown, and it's simply impossible to collect those. So we're allowing one distributee to do it on behalf of them, or in some cases we're allowing, or also allowing the attorney on behalf of all distributees to file that affidavit and file it. And so we, that's what we're doing on page 1 in the first section there. When you get to the bottom of page 5, we're clarifying these affidavits can be used in either proceedings, whether there's their testate with a will or intestate without a will. And we're all, and then if you switch over to page 6, what we're doing here is we're just also making clear on page 6 that when you're claiming to be a distributee, that we're also allowing a legal basis for this to actually jump generations. In some places in Wyoming now, if this was a if you found personal property that belonged to a great-grandfather, you would have, some courts are making you do this at each level. So you have to file one of these affidavits at the at your grandparents' level. You'd have to file another one at your parents' level. And even though they're all gone, you still have to do that and get it down to the distributees. We're now allowing that in the right circumstances. When you provide the basis in the affidavit, you can skip generations in doing so. Then we're also then clarifying about in the affidavit to let everybody know if there has been a will or a probate filed outside of Wyoming. So this person may have been a resident of another state, and so we're just trying to deal with his property inside the state. Providing that information, if there is an action or a probate going on in another state, that information provided. That's the top of pages, bottom of page 6 and top of page 7. And then the rest of it is, I think, is mostly clarifying and clarifying language with respect to the affidavit. So then that gets us down to where we start with real property. And the real, before we go on page 8, one of the things that we found is that in some places that when you've been presented with these affidavits, you've had some places, stockbrokers or some banks and out-of-state institutions in particular, that have refused to honor the affidavit unless they have an order from a judge or not willing to comply with Wyoming law and provide that. So in what we're doing at the bottom of page 8 and across page 9 is in 2-1-202, we're changing that to make it clear that when you're presented with these affidavits, you have to turn it over. And if you don't, and the estate or the distributees have to file an action to make you turn it over, that you're going to be saddled with potential damages for loss of value, but more particularly, that you're going to have to reimburse them for the attorney's fees and costs in making them go and make the affidavit enforceable when it should be clearly enforceable under Wyoming law. So ultimately, if they don't turn over in 45 days, then they're subject to those potential sanctions. That takes us through the affidavit provision. Then we get to the summary probate provision where you have a real property involved, and that starts on page 10. You're starting with 205, and the first thing you do is when a person dies, you file an application with the court for a decree which will order the disposition of this property under the will or the intestacy laws, again, in estates that have less than $200,000. So we see some clarifying language on the bottom of page 10 with that. When you go to page 11, you're seeing there that there's language there where we had clarifying language where you would file that. You do it in the county. If the person was a resident of Wyoming, then you're going to file that application in the county where he was lived. If he's not a resident of Wyoming, you may file it in any county where there is property. And so we're just clarifying where that's going to be and where you would do that. Right now, in some places in Wyoming, some judges are refusing to recognize these things if they've been filed in one county to deal with property in that county. Some judges are saying, no, that's not effective in a neighboring county, and you have to do the same thing again in a neighboring county. This is going to make it clear that once we do this, it's going to be effective all across Wyoming in any county. And for the body's edification, generally district courts do have general jurisdiction Any district court in our state has jurisdiction over land inside the state. So we thought that that was appropriate and clarifies that. So that continues to be equal treatment throughout Wyoming. We're also on in page 11, including that real property includes mineral interests, although some judges have not believed that. So in the middle of, on line 19 of page 11, we're making sure that mineral interests are included in there. We're also including in, for years it's been practiced at the bottom of page 11 that you would use broker, current market analysis, sometimes called the broker price opinion, as a basis to form the value estimate for these probates. That's been there for a long time. We had, if you remember, a few years ago, there was a bill about broker price opinions. Brokers are very, very conscious about having anything named an appraisal, even though in the statute it's a different than a certified appraisal. But we're removing the word appraisal and simply requiring a sworn report of value and specifying that it may be based upon, it doesn't have to be, but it may be based upon a broker's price opinion, which you recognized a few years ago. Again, that property has, we're only talking about property located in Wyoming. So we do that, then we get down here in D, we're trying to make this compliant with the United States Supreme Court case that talks about when you do these things, you have to provide the right notice. And so we're requiring here that when you do these things, we're now putting in statute that you have to provide, when you provide the application, you've also got to provide notice to any, to the surviving spouse, if there is one, because the surviving spouse often has, unless there's some prenuptial agreement or something like that, is going to have certain rights in the estate of their deceased spouse. We're also making sure that you advise all distributees that they're entitled to this, and also any known creditors. You have to notify them so that they have the opportunity to object. Ultimately, you file this application in the court. Then you file in the newspaper and provide these notices. The newspaper has to be published in the county where the application is filed for at least 2 weeks. Then after that, if there's no objection, filed within 30 days. We're in the middle of page 13. Then you can apply to the court for a decree, and if the court agree, looks and everything is in order, the court will file the decree. The decree can then be filed in the real estate records, recorded in the real estate records. It would be very similar to a bill or a personal representative's a warranty deed or a personal representative's deed that came out of an estate and would resolve those issues. So that's what happens. So we've modified that language to clarify that. We're making sure that it can be, again, be one distributee on behalf of all distributees. Oftentimes that's a personal representative. And also outlining that some new language in the middle of page 14, that when you come and do these things, whether it's an affidavit or this application, it's done under oath, and making sure that while the person who complies with the decree or the affidavit, if they've when they've complied with it, they're not liable. But certainly, if a distributee or the applicant under these things makes materially false statements, they are held civilly liable for that fraud or for that for making those false statements and for the effects that have. So that takes care, that updates the language. Then if you go back now, we have new statutes that flesh out this a little bit more. If you go back to page 1, you now see that there's a new 21206. So this is, that's going to be added now. We're providing here proof of publication that needs to be filed before the court can take action. And also the proof of service that you've notified the surviving spouse if there was one, any known ascertainable creditors, and then proof of your publication has to be filed before the court take action on the decree. We're then in the bottom of page 2, we're talking about a new section, so we're specifically dealing with if we can't locate, we don't know where a distributee is and they can't be found, how we identify them. You have to try and find them. If you can't, you need to tell the court what you did to try and find them. We're allowing the property in real interest. If we can't find a missing distributee, that can be sent over to that missing distributee's name. They'll just have to be dealt with in that person's estate at some point, but it won't hold up the others from having that done. Some courts are allowing that to be done now. Some aren't, so this will make it clear that that can happen. Then finally, we get down here. If it's personal property, that property can be liquidated, or if it's a bank account, that missing distributee share can be turned over to the treasurer under the Unclaimed Property Act and held there until it's claimed. We're also, in some instances, at the bottom of page 3, where if the instances are correct, the judge can order and allow property to be sold so that that missing distributee share could be deposited with the unclaimed property on behalf of the missing distributee. Then in 2-208, this is what the standing committee, the committee of the whole amendment did, is deal with venue. Just makes it again clear for real property, for these decrees, where they're filed and where you file them. And as far as, and it's basically the same. It was filed in the county where the person was a resident, if they're a resident of Wyoming. If they weren't a resident, then the county where any of the property of the state is. And so that's the bill. It's been vetted by a number of people. I would also advise you that there are certain, there's a lot of practitioners out there that would like to see the 30-day waiting period advised to 20, or reduced to 20-day waiting period after the notice has gone out. But that certainly is it would be a simple change that could happen on second reading if someone was interested in doing that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my explanation. I would stand for questions, and if there are none, I'd ask for favorable consideration.
Senator Bebout.
Just a couple of questions for the sponsor and some of the thinking behind it. And on page 9, we're talking about the 45-day holding period for legal fees for cause of action. And a lot of times when you have some of these estates, you have mineral interests that they're so hard to determine and find out. How does that affect this? Because a lot of times they may not know, and sometimes it's 6 months or later before they realize that. And I know there's a cause there. I just would like to talk about that to see how that might play into that. And the second part of that, Mr. Chairman, is on page 11. You know, now the language that I understand before, you shall have a sworn appraisal. Now we're going to say we may have a value. And I know it refers to another statute, but how is that going to work in determining your interest and your value?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the language at the bottom of page 9 only refers to the affidavit, and the affidavit it can only be with personal property. So if mineral interests and things like that are real property, Mr. Chairman, and so those would never be, that would not be applicable to that. This is generally, and where this comes up is you've got a stockbroker, you've got a bank account, you've got a savings and loan. Not, they don't have those anymore. We have a credit union that's holding this, and they're saying they're not going to turn it over, even though Wyoming law says they need to turn it over. And if they, and when they turn it over and get the receipt that they demonstrate that they have turned it over, they have a release. And so there's some that, in spite of that, are not allowing that to be done. And so this provides, and there's no penalty under current law. There's nothing that happens to them for saying no. And so this provides some teeth so that, again, only with personal property, and usually it's intangible personal property like bank accounts or stocks or bonds, those types of things, when they're refusing to turn those over, this provides some teeth so that they have to turn them over. Otherwise, they can, you know, then it seems only fair. The idea is it's only fair if they're refusing to turn over in the face and in defiance of Wyoming law, that then when you have to go enforce the Wyoming law, that they have to pay the cost for them standing on their whatever principles they have for not turning it over. Hopefully that answers that question. The other question I thought we had was on the, help me, what was the other, Mr. The other, if I can remember the other question, I've forgotten it.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bottom of page 11, the previous language said that it was shall and you would have an appraisal determined value. Now you've made it may and it's called based on a broker's prices opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason that is the law has held that this appraisal was never under the law, was never a certified appraisal. It was never an actual appraiser who was supposed to do that. That's a broader term that came, and ultimately it just had to be someone who's familiar under, if you go back and look at the what's been over time, it's just someone who's familiar with the property and maybe familiar with property values in the area, but nevertheless is familiar with that property, doesn't have an interest in the property. They oftentimes in this and in other condemnation proceedings and things, you appoint a board of appraisers. And the appraisers was never board certified appraisers as we use that term today, but in the law it's just someone who's disinterested, means they don't have a personal or financial interest in the property, but are familiar with it. And so they can go out and look at that property and give the, quote, appraisal. What has been practiced for many years in Wyoming is simply when you're doing these things, you had the sworn report of appraisal that was required in these things. Again, it's never been that you had to have certified appraisal. You certainly can, but you just have to have a disinterested appraisal. For years, the practice has been, and courts have accepted, that current market analysis or broker price opinions from realtors were sufficient enough to establish the basis for these types of purposes. And so, but what's happened is with the legislation we did a few years ago to make it clear that broker's price opinions were not practicing the law, the profession of appraising without a license. So this just makes it clear that, and again, all it ever was an opinion from an uninterested party of what the value was, and not necessarily an appraisal as we kind of think of generally in the context of property. So in the end, I don't think it's changed anything. And in fact, the practice across the strait has been that there, you provide sworn, and you still have to, still mandatory, you have to have this disinterested party provide a sworn estimate of value, which is really what the practice has been for probably the last 25 to 30 years.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, following up on the last description, so this language was just explained and discussed for the changing from appraisal of value is in that area where you're allowed to have a distribution by affidavit, which means that there's going to be less notice provided to the public and a smaller opportunity for creditors and others to see a probate that requires notice to creditors and payment of creditors. And I suspect I have at least once to twice a year a creditor or even a family member coming in and saying, what happened to that estate? I didn't get paid, or I didn't get a piece of the ranch or whatever, and I never saw anything. I never really got notice. And oftentimes we go back and find out the distribution of affidavit is, and there are differing practices among attorneys practicing throughout the state as to what diligence. But I guess my concern is the language at the bottom of 11 and top of 12, does it lower the bar to promote the activity where now instead of having to have swear that, yes, in fact, this is the appraised value, you just get anybody to come in and said, well, I think the value of the property is 200 and there's no justification for it. Somebody, and then the property gets distributed because it's under the $200,000 bar. Then folks come back and said, wait a minute, that was a $500,000 piece of property. They go back, they see this declaration of value, and the affiant simply says, that's what I thought it was worth. Meanwhile, the creditors aren't getting paid. So there is an opportunity. Every time you lower the bar for using the expedited process, you do limit the offer. You enable folks to distribute those assets more easily and not provide the same kind of notice, and potentially creditors are at risk. So if we could have a discussion about that with respect to what is the bar, what's the protection to make sure that folks are not abusing this distribution method.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that's one of the things that this bill does in particular is, going back to the notice provisions, this bill, in the current law, there is nothing that requires, when you're doing these summary probate, there's nothing that actually requires notice to creditors to be done before you file the application or when you file the application and prior to the entry of the decree. This bill actually writes in the fact that now you have to notify creditors. Any creditors that are reasonably ascertainable, you have to send them by first class mail notice that you're doing this. If there's anybody else that is in the that either is an heir under intestacy law or that is named in the will or is an heir under the will, you have to provide them notice. And so, and additionally, you also have to provide any surviving spouse with notice that this is happening, because surviving spouses have certain rights in property, in a probate. And so this bill actually raises the level of notice and who gets notice, that now everybody has to receive this additional notice. So it raises the bar substantially in who gets notice before these things happen. So I actually think it'll go a long way to reducing the mischief that is sometimes happens around the state when people run these things through really quick, very quickly. And so it gives some additional direction to the judge who's looking at these things before he does that notice is provided, that notice is provided. With respect to I don't think it changes the bar, quite frankly. I don't think that the language, Mr. Chairman, changes the bar on five. The again, when you look at the existing statute, I think it wasn't the way it says on the bottom of page five. Where was it? It was the with the broker's price opinion, where it talks about the value. It's on page 11. You're talking about the sworn report of appraisal. Again, that's for years, this is very similar. You find a similar language in the statutes that provide for condemnation of rights of way by county commissioners. You go out there, you appoint appraisers. The appraisers that you're appointing oftentimes aren't certified appraisers. They're just individuals who are familiar with the area, familiar with the land, but don't have a financial or personal interest in the property. And so in doing this, what we're trying to do is not require. We're simply making what the attempt is, and if there's some language that would firm that up, we'd certainly be viewed as a friendly amendment. But ultimately, trying to make sure that when people understand if a broker's price opinion or a market analysis which under that statute is a licensed realtor, when they provide that this clarifies that is a sufficient basis. But if there's some additional language that the good senator from over the hill or others think would make that, lock that in and resolve those concerns, that those would be viewed as friendlier amendments, because the point was simply to clarify and make sure that what happens now in existing practice is everybody understands that's often what's done, though not always, but that's often what's done, and will be acceptable moving forward.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I think with respect to people have to remember that realtors are not appraisers. They're not sworn to any type of a code to provide valuations under any circumstances. They're simply people that buy and sell property and have developed opinions. And there's, but I believe the remedy is, as long as you're given notice, if you don't like the sworn affidavit, you've got 30 days to act. You must move in and seek a probate and request a probate of the action. I think that's the remedy, so that it's really the notification period. You need to act if you don't like the allegation or the valuation, and the sponsor might address that. And then the other thing that I would like the sponsor address is going back to missing distributees over at pages 2 through 3. There's no definition of a missing distributee, and I understand the problem that practitioners have in this respect, but if we go back to the, if you do more work in title examinations and you begin working with what a missing distributee is and who a decedent is when they become missing, we have a process that folks use, and we use the mineral deeds as an example, where you may be trying to determine the heirship of property that where there was no probate going back 2 or 3 generations. And throughout that process, you have to decide, well, are we going to use a determinative heirship process, or are we going to probate a particular person's estate? I'm a little concerned that with this language and by creating this new person that's a missing distributee, that you're forcing determination of heirships or probates where you might, and I think there are instances where you would do a probate, and you would say after the decedent passed away, his children pass away, and then they pass away, and then we're actually asking the court to interpret the various wills below as well, and saying, as it stands today, this is the person entitled to the heirship, if you will. And it looks to me like now you're limiting the probate for the court to only look at the decedent in terms of at the time of his death. So all you can say is, well, the children are all missing because, actually, they're not missing in a sense. We know they are. They're over in the graveyard. But they're missing in the sense that we can't give them notice, and you can't determine the heirship below them. So I guess a question I would have is, have you inadvertently created a situation here where the anybody whom is you believe is a decedent but is also missing, that's as far as you can probate in a single probate, and you're not entitled to look beyond that, so you cannot determine heirship from anyone whose children have passed away a month or 6 months or a year or maybe 5 years after the death, but before the probate.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've tried to deal with that in the middle of page 6 on lines 12 through 18. One of the things we're trying to do there is if we're going to do that, if this is jumping a generation, what we're trying to do there is that when you come and make the application, that you have to provide the relationship of beginning at the end of line 11. You have to provide the relationship to the decedent, and concerning the legal basis upon which the distributee or distributees claim entitlement to such property, including facts regarding any intervening estates or other parties who may have claim of entitlement from the decedent and from the applicant, distributee, or distributee's claim that there are no other distributees who are entitled to that property in any jurisdiction. So we're trying to make sure that the point is in these things is they're supposed to be summary procedures, that we've got a cap on of $200,000. But again, here we're trying, I think that's where I think the attempt was in the bill, and this language came actually from a well-respected practitioner who came up and was concerned about those things. And so that's what we've got, and that's what we've tried to do to cover that. And so, again, if there's some additional language or something to do that a different way, those things would be used as friendly amendments. But we're trying to, in this, provide full disclosure so the wool's not pulled over anybody's eyes, so that we have, when we're doing this, it'll be clear we're providing notice, more notice that's ever been provided before, at least required under the statute. And so we're trying to address it in that regard.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would ask the sponsor just to look at that. With respect to the language on page 6, I see that language, and that language, in fact, is restricted to personal property, I believe, and not real estate. But more importantly, by defining what a missing person is, without the definition of a missing person, and then the mandate on page 3 that any probate shall give it to the name of the missing distributee, to me means that notwithstanding what you described that you'd like to do, you would have to do a separate affidavit for each and every person in the chain. Because once they're declared missing, your only opportunity under the top of page 3, you must provide and distribute it to that missing person. Then you'd have to go out and investigate that person, determine whether or not his estate was under $200,000, and over and over. And it may be the right thing to do, but it's an interesting problem.
Question. Further discussion? Question being called for. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation to Senate File 111, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. That bill is passed. Excuse me. Senate File 111 is passed Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration is Senate File 129. The reading clerk will read in the bill.
Senate File 129, Medicare Share Plan, sponsored by Senator Von Flatron. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Landon, Peterson, and Scott. No, Senator Driscoll, Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended, failed. In accordance with Senate Rule 5.4, Aye. Senators Hastert, no. Senators Burns, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Senator Ross, chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the committee of the whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that Senate file 129 do pass. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment from standing committee number one. What I propose we do is we'll get an explanation of the bill first, then we'll come back and request that standing committee amendment be read in, and then we've disposed of that one. Then we'll go to the standing committee from amendment from appropriations, the normal procedure, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, at this time, I would yield to Senator Von Flatern for an explanation of the bill.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity. Fellow senators, in front of you, you have Senate File 129, Medicaid Share Plan. This bill's goal is to assist a portion of our population that is less fortunate than everyone in this room, and at the same time, bring economic development to the state of Wyoming. The care provided by this piece of legislation is funded with federal dollars, but the plan itself is tailored to Wyoming's needs. Inclusive in this bill is very important, and is very important, are monthly premiums and the associated penalties for not paying them, and also co-payments for services received. It may be a new concept to some that use the system or are enrolled, but it is mandatory within the system. And then the big component that everybody's asked about, well, two big aspects of this bill. One is that all members will get assistance in finding a job. They'll be given everything that Workforce Services has to offer as far as assistance and training, resume writing, and everything that entails. This program is not designed to be a handout, but a hand up to those that can work their way out of poverty and eventually off the government assistance. This piece of legislation in front of you has been vetted by CMS, which is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. That is the agency that administers Medicaid for the federal government and approves, or not, all the state's Medicare, Medicaid programs. There may be amendments in the future that substantially change parts of this bill and may cause the state to renegotiate with the CMS for their approval, and once again take the chance of their disapproval. If you look at the two pages of the handout provided by the Department of Health, that should be on your desk. Has my name on top of it, and also has Wyoming Department of Health programs with potential offsets. You will see that there are great savings from the state's general fund over the expansion. This program will save enough in the future to pay for itself. And I'm sure myself or others will return to this topic later. If one was to consider all the programs this state and this body approves to further economic development, and by the simple passage of this bill, we may create up to 800 jobs. And we will definitely bring 100 plus to $120 million a year to this state. That's an easy business move, and it didn't cost the state anything. Hopefully, this will allow the small town hospitals to come closer to a break-even point. This won't solve all the hospital's problems. You've probably heard from your hospital administrators. They want this bill, but this will never solve all their problems, all their financial woes. This will make an attempt at it. This will help keep some of those small town hospitals going and bring them closer to a break-even point. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to explain the bill as soon as I can find my coffee. On page 1, section 1, we create a new section in Title 42. Page 2, under little I, we define alternative benefits plan, an ABP, which means and is authorized by this article. Page 2, capital B is the benefits benchmark 2. And this is important, is the components benchmark 2 actuarially equivalent to or otherwise similar to a commercial private insurance plan. So this is not a... This has good benefits involved. It is not something just created to have something provided to them. This is a very well-rounded system. Page 2, C, and other benefits as required. Page 3, if you go to capital D, this defines and talks about that the medically frail individuals and other populations deemed necessary by federal regulations are qualified recipients under this article. And on page definitions further of demonstration of a waiver is the little double I definition of programs means Medicare coverage for certain individuals authorized under this act. 42.4.402 is the temporary program. This allows us with CMS approval to begin as early as July 15th, although this bill will not go into effect till January 2016. That is the earliest. And that what this does is allow it to, but if you look at the financial statement, the fiscal statement on this bill, we're really talking a January 16 start. Page 4 under 42-4403, as soon as I can get there, Mr. Chairman, once again reiterates that we can start in July, and then who will implement, and only for those eligible. So page 5 under little I discusses negotiations with CMS for the waiver. Double I on that page talks about individuals with modified gross income above 100% and up to 133%. This program will actually cover to 138% because they forgive the first 5% of income. I may not be using the correct term on that. But that really is why up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which today would be for a family, for a single person would be about 11,000, give the 38%, you'd be up around 15,000 a year in adjusted gross income. So that is not a lot of money to try to live on. And then page 5, triple I on page 5 states the participants will pay a monthly premium. This is their skin in the game. This is where they're paying something to belong. This is not a free program. And onward to little 4, the penalty for not paying your premiums is detailed there. A participant who fails to pay required premiums for 90 days shall be disenrolled from the program. And then page 6, under Romanet 5, talks about the penalty again. Page 6, under Romanet 5, is the Healthy Lifestyle Challenge. It is introduced here, and it's an incentive to participate, and the incentive is given to new participants who will receive a premium, as written today, who will receive a premium discount for the following plan year. So there's the incentive for keeping yourself healthy. On 42.4.404B, once again, this reiterates the mentally ill and that the medically frail individuals and other populations deemed necessary. It's one of those two. You have to guess. It's medically frail is detailed there. On page 7, under little I discusses that less than 100% shall be eligible. It says individuals with income equal to or below 100% of the federal poverty level shall be eligible to become participants in the program under this section. So you have two different sections. You have the ones that make less than 100% of federal poverty level and those that make 101 to 138% of poverty level. And they handle the two of them differently. And that's through the rules that are present in CMS. Little double I on page 7 that under 100% shall not have to pay premiums. This is a requirement of CMS that those that have federal poverty level gross adjusted income under 100% shall not have to pay premiums. This is then 42.404,
405 on page 7, who shall apply and what services are available to the new recipients. Page 8 under double I, this is a health, the extent authorized by federal law, participants shall be required to complete a comprehensive health assessment upon enrollment. This will be all on paper to begin with, and this will be them filling out what kind of disease, what's their family history, so forth. So we get a baseline of where they stand and what kind of medical coverage they've had in the past and any ailments they may have. III talks about case management. They'll take the whole person. They'll put them through workforce services as far as what they'll be given at that point as far as work incentives. Under III, they'll also have case managers. So they'll look at the whole picture. And these people will be identified. That's an important part of this program, is we will identify who those people are. And IV, this is for participation in a work assistance program. IV is very important. This is where the work assistance benefit comes in. This is where they will learn about job search websites, resume assistance, and search the services for matching skills to the job and the job training. This is all a workforce services offers today. They'll automatically be enrolled in that. Page 9, line 1, this section deals with those that are eligible and employed. So if your employer offers insurance, and insurance is going to be more than 9.5% of the individual's modified adjusted gross income, if it's going to be more than that, they are eligible to participate in this program. So if they can get their under 9.5%, they have to take their employer's offered health insurance if it is somewhat equivalent. And then page 9, line 13 through 17. This is very important. This is that other biggest piece that was ever asked to me. Do you have in this bill that if the federal government's match ever falls below 90%, it says shall not be administered during any time period in which the federal medical assistance percentage as currently provided pursuant to 42 U.S.C. bill is less than 90%. So if the federal match ever goes below 90%, this program will end. There's your trigger in there. A lot of people had asked me about it. It's there. Section 2, page 9, this is the federal appropriation. Once again, this is $54 million. This is for 6 months. This is the first 6 months of 2016. That is the end of our biennium. That's why it only shows half a year's. So technically, it is about $108 million. If you talk about a full year, which the following year, they will be they will match 95% in year two. It will be about $108 million. For all of 2017, it will be $54 million because next year we're only counting through July in this bill. But all of 2016 will actually be $108 million. Will be coming to the state, going to your local doctors and hospitals, and covering, at least they'll be able to bill somebody, and at least for these new enrollees, at least their services will be paid for. Yes, it is at the Medicaid rates, but at least it's something better than zero. And your emergency room is getting zero today. And then we go on to page 10 and B. This is the appropriation from general fund. Once again, you may see this change. But at this point in this bill, there's $1.5 million to administer. Medicaid only pays 50-50 on administrative costs. So they pay 100% for all of 2016, but they'll only pay 50-50 of administrative costs. And they figure the administrative costs as 4%. There's another handout you have on your desk. Came from the department, and it shows the cost. And it's basically you take row C, row D, you add them together, and you get our total cost. And so the state general fund is the SGF in those rows. And as you can see, they allow 4% for administrative costs of the figure up above, which is the $52.6 million of state funds.
So we get 4% of that to administer this program, of which they match half. They match 100% of the Medicaid payments for 2016, dropping to 95% in 2017, but they pay only 50% on all Medicaid programs. And I think that pretty well explains the bill, Mr. Chairman. I will add, as my closing remarks, a week ago we had a past governor of a state back east that stood up at this very podium up here and spoke into the microphone. He was here for other reasons. But his state, which shall remain nameless, had actually accepted this Medicaid expansion well over a year ago. And it's a state that, and you know the leanings of that particular governor, but when he was asked by a reporter, said, why did your state, why did you accept the Medicaid expansion? His reply was, people are healthier, they're getting their lives back, they're getting jobs. We've been able to keep our promises to the mentally ill. Turning down that state's federal funds on an ideological basis, when people could lose their lives because they can get no help, doesn't make any sense to me. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I stand for questions.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I ask the Standing Committee Amendment from First Standing Committee, Committee Number 10, be read in at this time.
Reading clerk will read in the amendment.
Senate File 129, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, corrected copy, page 1, line 10.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, let me start out by explaining the need for the Standing Committee Amendment. And let me first emphasize that this amendment is a compromise between the two bills that were before the Senate and before the legislature, the Share Plan bill and the Joint Interim Labor Committee bill that was modeled on the Healthy Indiana program. And the two bills were obviously competing. Madam Co-Chairman from the House and I went to the governor's office and said we need to try to work out a compromise, and this is the compromise that was worked out. Let me explain, they said, why we need to have a compromise. The Medicaid program and the bill before us now is really just an expansion of the medical part, conventional expansion, the medical part of the Medicaid program, has some major problems. First, it costs too much. Second, it doesn't do that much good for the recipients. And third, it creates a cliff that makes it difficult for people on this welfare program to take a better job and better themselves. On the cost, the best information I could find on that is on this handout that I had distributed, labeled Wyoming Health Plan Comparative Cost Analysis. This was presented to your Joint Interim Labor Committee. I got a 2009 date on it. That's where I got it, so it's old data. But I inquired. We don't have anything better. The experts tell me that they think that the numbers have increased, but the proportions are relatively the same. If you look, Mr. Chairman, in this handout, on the top line, what you see is the figures for our leading private insurer and what their average health plan cost was. And by that is meant does not include the administrative costs. It's the costs for health services plus and including what was paid in deductibles and co-payments by the recipients. And that figure is $3,068. Then it's compared to Medicaid. And the third line down is conventional Medicaid with the developmental disability population and the age-blind and disabled, the nursing home and near-nursing home populations removed, because those are not comparable. So we're talking about the population that is going to be the beneficiary of this expansion. And notice that the cost is 50% higher for the Medicaid population. 50%. Mr. Chairman, I know the numbers have increased, but I think the proportion will be the same. And that's one of the things that's wrong with a conventional Medicaid expansion. You notice the figures there for children. It's $1,000 versus $2,788. When this came out, I questioned it, talked to the people in the health department, and they said for the children part of it, they didn't think that it was quite comparable, that there was probably some more expensive DD cases that you wouldn't find in comparable private insurance, and the real figure is closer to $2,000. Twice what Medicaid does. Why is that? These are the numbers that says that is. Medicaid is designed to be a very high-cost program. It's very rich, richer than most insurance, Mr. Chairman, that you and I can buy. And it doesn't have any meaningful incentives to control the costs. And this is the result. And I will submit to you, I believe this is the result not just in Wyoming, but from what I've seen in my experience, it's the result right across the United States. And it has to do with the design of the program at the federal level. Now, it may be justified, Mr. Chairman, to spend more money if you get better results, but you don't. It was a very interesting natural experiment occurred in the state of Oregon. And what happened was, in the days before the ACA was enacted, before the federal reform, they tried a Medicaid expansion, the same population, tried a Medicaid expansion on their own and couldn't afford it. It cost more than they thought it was going to. So they got permission to do a lottery. I think odd case numbers went to the expansion. Others were refused and stayed with where they'd been. And the result was you had a natural, almost randomized control trial. And that's been the subject of a number of studies, including one that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I will summarize what they found. First thing they found was, sure enough, the patients on the Medicare program, the Medicaid program, cost 35% more. Not surprising. Even though Medicaid doesn't pay full cost, they cost 35% more. The second thing they found was that emergency room use went up instead of down. And then they looked as best they could at measures of did it help people get healthier, and found a very mixed bag. They didn't run it long enough because the ACA came along and made it obsolete. They didn't run it long enough to really get a good handle on mortality and morbidity. So they were looking at proxy measures. And they found a little improvement, maybe. Well, they found there were more mental health services used. They say they found emergency room use increased. They found that the various measures of potential heart disease, cholesterol, that sort of thing, blood pressure, didn't change in a statistically significant fashion. There was a little improvement that was statistically significant in the what's called the A1C, which is the key measure of success with diabetics. Overall, they found really very little improvement for the extra spending. So that's my concerns on the cost and outcome levels. And the other thing that we find with this program, when you do a welfare program, at least when we do one here in Wyoming, Mr. Chairman, we want to see, do we create a barrier for people taking that next better job, that next promotion that might raise them up above the level which you receive welfare? And we try to avoid those kind of barriers. The Medicaid program in the bill provides you with a major barrier. And remember, we're expanding from just pregnant women and children to all kinds of single adults here. You earn $1 over that 138% of the federal poverty level, you're out. It's not safe to take a small promotion. And that, I submit to you, Mr. Chairman, is a major problem in a welfare program like this. It is an obstacle designed, whether intentionally or not, but nonetheless designed to keep people in bondage to the welfare system. Okay, what are we going to do about it? And, Mr. Chairman, I don't claim any magic that the solution I'm proposing is going to be fully adequate, but it's the best that I and the Joint Committee could come up with and could negotiate. Because, again, this is a compromise. Looking at the amendment, what do? We create a thing called a personal health and wellness account. We stole that name. We stole that definition from the state of Indiana, where, incidentally, their proposal was just approved within the past week by the federal government. And we'll call it a health savings account, but it isn't quite the same as the health savings account that is the tax-benefited account that we're used to in the tax code that some of us have, that is a tried-and-true account, but it's very much on the same principles. And you can see the definition there in the amendment. We do some things merging it in. We say we're going to cover the whole expansion population, not just that above 100% as the bill does. At the bottom of the first page of the amendment, the feds have a limit with this income population of 5% of income that can be for cost share. And you can say it's right or wrong, but you're dealing with a low-income population. The federal 5% limit is not unreasonable. So we stick with that, but it's structured so only the premiums that are paid count against that 5% limit. They're deposited into this personal health and wellness account, this health savings account. And that enables you, if you have sufficient incentives for people to want to conserve the money in that account so they can use it for their own purposes in the health area, that enables you to use the kind of conventional co-payments, deductibles too, but co-payments are much more effective, that all of those of us with private insurance are used to. Things that are a real incentive to not, for example, take the example that's the most common problem, abuse the use of the emergency room, Mr. Chairman. The And that is a problem with this, with Medicaid, this population. It'll come out of your health savings account. There is a provision in the bill as it stands, is a provision that if you don't pay the premiums, you get disenrolled. At the time, that was written at the time we had the testimony in committee from the health department. They said, well, we wrote that in, you can do it, but you got to let them re-enroll the next day. And then after that, they were telling us the truth as they knew the truth at that time. After that, the feds changed the rules and said you can really disenroll them and leave them disenrolled for 6 months because that's what they approved in Indiana. Surprise to everybody. But what this does is say, okay, but what happens to you is you lose the balance that was in your personal health and wealth account if you stop paying the premiums. So there's more of a sanction. And one I think will pass the muster and be a more sensible way to deal with it. And then starting at the bottom of page 2, you see the specifics on the health savings account, the personal health and wellness account. I would call your attention, the bottom of page 2, here's what happens when people burn through all the money in that. And that will legitimately happen. Mr. Chairman, when it happens with the normal middle class insured population that has an HSA account as part of their employer-based insurance, okay, middle class people can deal with that. You can pay it directly. You can use the great American technique of putting it on plastic. You can make things work. Lower income population probably can't do that. So you have to do something special. And the bottom of page 2 in the amendment is that special. What we do is we have Medicaid pay those co-payments and then keep the incentive there. We increase the premium going forward that's charged to the insured the clients. That's a key concept. It's not one that has been done elsewhere. This will be something new for CMS they're going to have to think about. Okay, what about the account? Begins with a balance of $500. And here was a key concept that we developed in the negotiations. One of the senators here came up with the idea of virtual money. And it actually works. What it is, Mr. Chairman, is very much like you get advertising come on from a big box retailer in the mall that says, you've got a gift card with $25 on it. They just printed that. They didn't set aside any money. You come in with that and you spend their limits and it's effective advertising. It brings you into the store. This is in some way the same kind of concept, a financial thing, because CMS won't, and they're pretty clear on this, they won't front load one of these accounts they never have elsewhere. But this thing, we're not asking them to do anything except when you draw the account down. Then they got to pay. So our bookkeeping shows you took $100 out to pay the copayment for a covered service, which is what it's for. Okay, that's fine. We send the bill to CMS, they pay the real money that's needed. And they'll do that. And they'll pay the rest of the balance, too. And, you know, where they get the money, that's their problem. You know, the U.S. government is regularly printing it, regularly selling debt to Chinese and anybody else that'll buy it. That's where it's coming from. The amendment provides that we'll put another $50 every month on that account because people will gradually deplete it from normal expenses. We expect that. You need to keep it up. You need to have a big incentive for people to conserve this. And the main one we came up to, You can see it on page 3 of the amendment starting on line 11. If the individual leaves the Medicaid program, retain the account for a period of 1 year, and may use any balance over $600 to pay premiums, deductibles, and co-payments on private insurance plans qualified, and you can see the rest of that. That deals, Mr. Chairman, with the problem of the cliff. It makes it easier to take that slightly better job. It eases that transition. This will be a new concept for the CMS. They have done these things, paid premiums, paid deductibles, paid co-payments on private insurance and some specialized programs within Medicaid where it made some financial sense. We're asking them to do it here so that this, when this money gets translated here into a real expenditure for a medical service, they'll pay it. And the amendment specified, when we have to do these, we want something called an 1115 waiver. If the waiver does not so provide, the state shall not agree to the waiver. So this is a condition. It'll cause the top management of CMS to have to make a decision. My judgment is that the decision will probably be favorable. We continually are surprised by the things they have agreed to. Then you have provisions, and the reason for the $600 is so somebody can't come in and 30 days later depart with our money and or the Fed's money and spend it somewhere, and it has to be for these medical things. Then there's a provision where people come back after a year. You negotiate waivers, responsibility of the governor. This is going to require high-level negotiation. That's been true in all the other states that have gotten anything that's other than just a conventional waiver. You have a task force to assist him. You can see that. Carry out, it'll administer the language, the health savings account portion of the waiver, including the enrollment in the personal health and wellness account, and there will be some significant spending here, not tremendous amount, but it not be insignificant either. My guess is between $100 and $200 a participant. In private insurance, when you buy a new insurance policy, different insurance policy, your agent will sit down with you, either in person or over the telephone, explain how the new system works. You have to do that with this population, and you have to allow, it's going to take more explaining because they're not used to private health insurance, by and large. Some of them are. Some of them have private health insurance. But for many, it will be a new concept, and it'll take a while and take some effort. And then you have the provisions for the contracting. They're pretty straightforward. I would point out the very last item in the amendment on page 4. Contract may require contractors to assist in the enrollment process. The reason for that is that what we're hearing, we've got a brand new Medicaid enrollment system. What we're hearing is it's simply not working, and people are not getting through it, and that our enrollments and some of our other programs are falling in consequence. And there's a lot of hand processing going on, so this enables us, if they don't get that fixed in the next year, to ask your contractors for assistance. Mr. Chairman, that's the amendment, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First question is, what would the cost be to us, an idea on that, and then how that rolls through on the copay and the premiums when you do the copays because you have your account, and then it's backfilled or replenished as you roll through it. If you could get some more discussion on that. And then, as I understand, one of the differences on this, if the with yours you're not forced into cost sharing, but with the other one on the original share plan, It works differently in the sense of how that flows through the individual. So could you help us out a little bit on that?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I'll do my best to remember everything on how it works for the individuals. In conventional Medicaid, there are theoretically copayments that can be charged, and frankly, they're sufficiently nominal. The providers don't, by and large, bother to collect them, so they don't affect the individuals much. In this one, the copayments will be the same kind of things that you and I face, so they'll be significant. And if you pay them out of the personal health and wellness account, the individual does, and there's mechanical arrangements that have to be worked out when you do the waiver as to what kind of consent do you need from the individual and that sort of thing, and what kind of statements do you send him saying what's happened. But the copayments are not out of the individual's pocket. What comes out of the individual's pocket is the premiums that go into the account. And they run, in the first instance, 2% of their adjusted gross income. And you, mechanically, I'm sure you'll have a chart. Indiana had a chart. Between thus and such and thus and such income, here's your premium. And here's how it varies. You need to do that. But you've got to comply with the federal requirements there. And then that goes up if the Medicaid has to pay some of those copayments because they've run through it, as was explained. But all that 5% limit is applied against the premiums so that you can charge more premium as people make use of their accounts. So you preserve the incentive to be careful. The copayments do not get paid directly by the individual. They authorize them coming out of the account, which then, and this leads to your cash flow question, the feds pay those. And it will be a matter of negotiation with the feds and what their practices are, how quickly they'll pay them, whether we have to use some of the money that's appropriated for Medicaid to pay and then get reimbursed. That we don't spell that out, because as long as they ultimately pay them in reasonable time, and I think there's every reason to believe that they will, that's frankly not a problem. I hope that answered the question.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, just if I look on your amendment on page 3, lines starting on line 4, each of these accounts shall begin with a balance of $500, so I'm assuming you would take 500 times 17,000 or whatever that number is, and then $50 per month is added for each month of which the balance is below 2,500. So is there a phase in on that? I'm confused there. And then all of these funds shall be the property of the state. And so, I mean, so I guess we're going to set up general fund money. This is the virtual money, and it's like, I guess this is where the virtual money comes in. I'm kind of old-fashioned, you know, a dollar is a dollar. Maybe you could help me out.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The issue with respect to the health welfare account, HSA, is complex to understand, and I'll be honest that I don't understand it yet, and I would like to understand it before we vote on this amendment. And I don't know why it's so difficult to explain, and that gives me concern in itself. So as I understand it, for example, one of the reasons why, as I understand it, the sponsor is convinced that the HSA is a better tool to use is because of the cliff. I understand that the cliff that is concerned about is that if you make a dollar over the federal poverty amount, you're ineligible. And the idea then is that as you move off of the plan, you would have the opportunity to use part of the health savings account to help pay for your premiums, and I assume until the dollars are exhausted. And I assumed that from the description that the federal government under the base waiver will not provide those benefits. It's either you're either off or on. So let's talk about the health savings account. As I understand what is described is that you'll get a credit to your account of a monetary value of $500. And that is now called virtual money. The reason it's virtual is because when you go to the physician, you incur a cost, and it's charged against your HSA amount, and then the charge is submitted as the medical cost to the Medicaid program, which reimburses the account. And at the same time, you're contributing anywhere from $1 to $50 to $60 per month of your own money into the HSA. So suppose you're on the account for a year, and let's suppose your own dollars you've actually contributed are $12, a dollar a month. Let's suppose you've been putting in $50 a month, and do the math, I suppose, you got $600. And I guess the next question is, have you used the account? If you've used the account, what dollars get used first? The dollars you put in that are your money that are not virtual because you contributed that premium, or the virtual dollars? But let's assume that you consumed them all. You went to a couple doctor visits and the doctors are gone. Maybe a better example is this. Let's assume I've only contributed a dollar a month. And let's assume I did not go to the doctor all year, didn't have need to go even to primary care. So at the end of the year, I've got this virtual account, and I contribute a dollar a year, so I've got $12 in there, and I get a better job. Would you explain to us then what happens if the notion is that 500 virtual money is available to help me pay my insurance premiums or otherwise, then I don't understand how it is that the money would ever come back. Because if I say, great, I want now $50 a month to be applied to my health insurance, I assume that's not something that can be billed to Medicaid in return. So is that a general fund obligation? Who pays for it? But I simply don't understand the whole notion yet. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, your description of how it works, Mr. Chairman, that description is entirely accurate until the very end. And then the waiver will provide that when you leave, now first, in the example that was given, you wind up with $1,112 in the account. You leave, you get a better job. $600 of that remains in the account. So in this example, $512 can be taken to use to pay those premiums and deductibles and whatnot, co-payments, with private insurance. And you've got 12 months to use them. The waiver, the way this is written, the waiver has to provide that the federal government will pay that real money as part of the Medicaid program. And there may well be some time periods involved. We may have to negotiate some stuff with the feds there. Because typically when people leave, they don't automatically get kicked off at once. There's an annual review that kicks them off. So there'll probably be a time period where they're still technically in the Medicaid program
but they've gone out, they've gotten private insurance, so they'd be off. They've taken this account with them. It's a new concept to the feds. It gives you the incentive to make this account work, so people will use it to be careful about their health spending. But the federal government pays within the Medicaid program, or the waiver does not go through. Mr. Chairman, the federal government has never confronted this kind of proposal before. We'll see how they react. The 1115 waiver and their existing prior practices show they have the authority to approve this. It'll take some persuasion to make them approve it. But at this point, they are sufficiently hungry to get more states in that I think they will approve. But Mr. Chairman, that was a very good simple example of how this works. It doesn't show any state general fund going out until in the second year of this, in calendar year 2017, state has to pay 5% of the Medicaid costs. Then you start getting into state general fund dollars.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Just kind of a technical question. I'm looking at... And I guess we're on Standing Committee Amendment 1-1. It says delete 42-4-407 and insert 42-4-406, and that's in the Section 1, which is just basically what the Act is about. But I don't see any place where in the amendment we delete the lines on page 9, 10 through 17, 42-407. And so my question is 42-4-407 the federal funding contingency if it drops below 90%? If we pass this amendment, is it in or is it out?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the reference is to 42-407, which is the trigger provision. This amendment does not change that. That remains in the bill. I would point out while I'm up one thing, related thing that the amendment does change. There is a provision on page 3, 42-4-402, temporary Medicaid expansion, that would have us begin a conventional Medicaid expansion, as I read it, almost instantly. And that provision is removed, because that would remove our bargaining position. You put that in there, you're going to get a conventional Medicaid expansion and the rest of it superfluous verbiage. So that provision comes out as well with the amendment.
Senator Meyer.
I'm wondering why on page 1, line 1, we're deleting the 42-407. To me, that would probably stay in there, and that language isn't supposed to be there. So tell me why it's there. I'm still not tracking this.
Understand. What happens is the amendment compressed two sections in the original bill.
Okay.
So there's one section less, so the LSO is renumbered. The text you see is 42-4407. Remains, but it's section number changes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to address a couple of the questions and clarify a little further on the cost and the cash flow concept of the virtual money. So two points here that I want to discuss. The first is that cash flow aspect of the virtual money and how it works, I think, was well described. The key is, as long as the state never allows funds below that $600 to leave the state, that $600 number being on page 3, line 14, which indicates that none of the balance below the $600 level can leave that protects that $500 as being simply cash flow. So there's no possibility of accessing the state funds of the HSA, the portion that is the state's payment at $500. So it really is, from that aspect, a neutral general fund obligation for the state of Wyoming. It's simply a matter of cash flow. The place where the possibility expense that's discussed in Romanet 4 comes in, that is, I feel, a much more threatening provision than my tall friend from Natrona County, is the an amount of $50. This is line 6 on page 3. An amount of $50 per month shall be added to the PHWA. So the concept there is who adds that money. Romanet 4 indicates basically that that money is going to be the responsibility of the federal government after basically the first $100 or whatever else. And this is something the state has not shown a willingness to do. Excuse me, the federal government, CMS, has not shown a willingness to do yet. So this is pushing beyond what some of us consider to be the envelope that CMS is willing to approve. This, in my opinion, goes beyond a red line and would not be approved, so there wouldn't be any possibility of having the transition of those additional funds to the individual. Only the funds that the individual has put in would be available. The only circumstance that's an exception to that that we've heard from CMS is the possibility of a 50-50 administrative match. So there might be a possibility within the negotiating scope of what CMS has done in the past that half of that money would be available from the feds and half of it available from the state of Wyoming, but we would be obligated then for half of that based on what they've done in the past. And I am very concerned that that would lead to us trying to negotiate something which would not be approved, and you can see on lines 21 and 22 of the amendment that if they won't go for this provision, there won't be a waiver. So there's a real concern over the possibility of implementing this from that standpoint. To address the majority floor leader's question about the cost of this, while the cost of the $500 front funding is not a general fund obligation and is basically a cash flow matter, there is an associated cost with this particular amendment, which goes to the implementation of the contract portion of it and the case management potentially by the private sector, which there isn't a specific fiscal note for. There was some discussion about that being perhaps $800,000 of state obligation for a year. But again, that was a very general guess, and it would be hard to put a price on that without doing further research. That $800,000 would be the state's portion. It would be matched by another $800,000 of administrative 50-50 match by the feds. And again, I'd invite the tall senator to perhaps go into his analysis on how he arrived at those numbers in the original discussion. But that would be the additional associated cost that can be anticipated. So the two concerns with costs are that additional administrative overhead and who would pay for those funds over the $600, which is, if it's the feds only, would be a showstopper potentially for them in terms of approving an 1115 waiver. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, my good colleague has, I think, set forth accurately some of the issues here. With regard to the $50 a month addition, that's just the same as the initial 500. We'd be treated exactly the same way. It's exactly the same sort of thing. It would not incur any obligation, and the feds would pay out real money when you used it for a covered medical service, or under the terms of this, when you took it with you because it was extra because it was over the $600 limit in the account. That is going to be the sticking point with CMS. They've not seen this kind of proposal before. There's no precedent. There is precedent for them spending on this sort of thing. They've done that before, but not in this context. It's essential to make this health savings account work because you've got to have the incentive to conserve the money. So the copayments coming out of it mean something, so that you choose not to go to the emergency room with the sniffles, but to do what the rest of us do and either consult Dr. Mom and see if it doesn't get better in a day or two, or go to
some any one of the numerous medical clinics there are, or your private physician. And I think we will push the use of medical homes. We're doing that all through the Medicaid program. It makes a lot of sense right here. With regard to the administrative cost, the estimate was between $100 and $200 a person, average. You know, average. Some people won't need much explanation. Some people will need a lot. It is based, to some extent, on the experience with the short-lived Healthy Frontiers program, where we were using a health savings account and found this to be necessary. And frankly, some of the lobby groups involved in that really pushed that, and they were dead right. It was something that was needed. The estimate was given, Mr. Chairman, was $880,000on general fund on a full year. I described that to the Appropriations Committee as a swag, and I'm sure you all know what a swag is. But that's what it is. And frankly, we probably have a better fix on it next year when we do the full budget. And in all probability, this will be implemented just slightly before that budget session, because it will take a while to get approved.
Senator Von Platen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of good conversation going on here. I will tell you, this cliff that was discussed, the once somebody went over the 138% and all of a sudden found themselves at 139%, on the marketplace exchange and the government subsidies that would follow you anyway, your insurance would not be that expensive. It wouldn't be suddenly your $800 out of pocket every month or $1,200. Your subsidy would be so high, you'd still be in that $20, $50, $60 a month. But even at that, for some people, it's hard to even come up with that $20, $40, or $60. So that part I wanted to straighten out. The other part about the Medicaid being designed to be a high-cost program, it was never designed that way. I could say it probably is, and I would probably agree with you, it may have grown that way. But it is not was never designed to be a high-cost program. There's something else on the amendment. It is line 26 on that first page, which says page 5, line 6, delete above 100%. When you delete that 100%, you have to remember they treat two different groups in this. They treat all the new eligible members under 100%, and they get treated one way. Everybody between 101 and 138 gets treated under different rules. By deleting that section there above 100%, by taking that out of there, all new members eligible for this will be treated the same. That's another concern that I'm sure we'll have with CMS, getting that negotiated. I'm not saying it's not negotiable. I'm just saying that it throws a barrier up to be negotiated with them. This whole personal health and wellness account that we've been discussing is another concept they'll have to look at in the fact that they are front-loading it, even though it's virtual, so they're not cash out of pocket. But as you use a gift card or whatever, however you want to look at this virtual money, they give you this credit card. Somebody at some point is going to have to pay that, whether they'll agree that it's virtual and not front-loaded by them in cash is something to be, once again, negotiated with them. The big problem I see coming up ahead, and I think it's been mentioned already, is the money in the account belongs to the state of Wyoming. If somebody leaves, everything below $600 belongs to us, even though we didn't put it in there to begin with. And they're glad. CMS will approve you taking your own money and any money the state put in goes to whoever owns that money originally. But they are very picky about ever letting the federal money go with somebody. And so that's what this does, and I think that'll be a showstopper too. So this is a great idea in many respects. I just don't think it's ready, and it would be very complicated for a population that has not dealt with even the slightest bit of paperwork, probably. A good share of them haven't, so I ask you no vote on the amendment.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman. There are, I've got, I wish I understood fully the virtual money concept, and it maybe take me the whole weekend to even sort through it all, but I suspect others have the same frustration I do, but there's three things that I think we really need to understand more. One is this CLIP discussion. Second area is the copay and the virtual money. I'll start with the virtual money. We've heard certain explanations, but as I understand it, we're going to credit somebody $500 equivalent value, the virtual money. Then we're going to credit that individual $50 per month, more virtual money. And so in the example that the good senator from Natrona County provided to us, after a year, you start with your $500, you accumulate at the rate of $50 per month. Over 12 months, that's $600. Now you've accumulated a value of $1,100 and you haven't used it. Your individual contributions were $12, a dollar a month. So now you got your own money in at $12. I assume all of the $1,100 is all virtual, in the sense that we don't actually put money in an account. We credit you something. So now we have $1,200 or $1,100 virtual money, and nobody's put any money in there. It's just virtual. So you're saying that if the individual departs from the program, only $600 is anything under $6, he can't withdraw. So he can only withdraw the difference between $600 and the $1,100 plus his $12 he put in himself. So I treat money as money, kind of like matter. It cannot be destroyed or created. And so the notion is somebody has to pay that. So if the payment is the federal government, now those are our tax dollars. We may not like the federal government, but we do understand that but for borrowing, it would be tax dollars that are paying for this program. So we're saying we're going to now write you a check out of tax dollars for leaving the program, because we'd rather pay you to leave you. So if I understand the logic behind it, it would be easier for me to understand why it would be persuasive to the federal government to say, Wyoming, you figure it out. You know, no other 49 states do not understand the Rosetta Stone, but you've read it. And if the notion is that what we get is that if you stayed on to get a credit above 600, we're going to encourage you to leave. But I'm trying to think about it. So every month you stay on the roll, you build a higher credit, and you stay on until your credit is large enough that the federal government now will pay your premiums. So when we began to talk about that cliff effect, what's the reverse cliff? If I'm trying to develop a credit to leave, don't I stay on longer to get the credit? I'm not sure. Now let me just talk about the issue of the cliff itself. If the cliff itself is the first cliff is 133% of the federal poverty level, it looks to me like our federal counterparts recognized the cliff and said, we're going to give a 5% swing so that if you don't have a cliff. I don't know, but somehow we get from 133% plus 5%. I assume that plus 5 is to try to prevent a cliff. Now the cliff isn't at 133, it's at 138. And even if we provide this incentive, sooner or later there's going to be a cliff. The subsidy is going to end. So I would like to understand more about what it is, this cliff, and why is it there, and can we achieve the same result without the HSA? I mean, part of what we're doing here, folks, is if we truly have a good idea, let's take it. But if we're putting a burden on the program that's already burdensome, now you have burdensome squared. And I think we owe it to ourselves to have that discussion. Is this a burden on a burden, or is it something that solves problem? The second thing that I do not understand, I would like to have explained, is the whole issue of copay. And that is, I understand what copay is. I walk in, I pay a bill, and when I walk out, I have to write a check for the difference between what the doctor's office, who just sent it, they've got my policy, and they know exactly what I've got to pay. I write a check. And in this instance, I believe under traditional Medicaid, I walk in, and I get the service, and I leave. Now I assume that there's some copay component, and then that copay is paid from this HSA. I don't understand the interaction between this account and the copay and how it ever hits my pocket, other than maybe that $12, which is less than my cell phone charge for one half of a month. But now I have other questions, by the way. I do want to get into issues with respect to the concern about the cost of care. But before we get into there, and I hate to drag it out, but I want to understand this. I would like to understand those things, the copay and these things, before we move on to other questions.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, first let's deal with the incentive to stay on in the $50 a month. When you work through the math, if I've done it right, as soon as you can earn 50 cents an hour more in a month, presuming a 200-hour month in terms of working, as soon as you can go over that, your money ahead not to wait and build the account up. So the incentive is there to go ahead and take that promotion. And for some of the people, yeah, they won't have big premiums maybe due to the subsidies, but those people typically with the insurance, if you get them through the exchange, which will be the less common, they'll have a big deductible. Big deductible. They run up to $5,000. And so that, any help with that is important. And if it's employer-based insurance, the premiums are likely to be higher and the deductible is not so bad, hopefully. Depends on the plan. With regard to the co-payments, Medicaid recipient who's got one of these accounts walks in the doctor's office, gets service, Medicaid. The doctor bills Medicaid exactly the way they do right now and gets paid exactly the way they do right now. What we do is we turn around and the administrator of the account then, say there was a $50 copay, deducts that from the account, and there's $50 less virtual money in the account. It's a bookkeeping transaction, but it's real to the people that are involved, because there's less money in the account and there's less that they can take with them when they go to the better employment. And we probably will put some other things in if it's over a certain amount and you can spend some on dental and vision. That's the kind of thing you negotiate in the deal with the CMS. And they've allowed that sort of thing in the past. So there'll probably be some other incentives there. But that's how that would work, and that answers the question of that it being the property of the state of Wyoming, that's not going to be a showstopper. There won't be a thin dime of federal money in that, that virtual money sitting in the account. It'll take them a while to understand it, because it is complicated, and it was forced on us by the fact the feds appear not to be willing to front-load the account. And we, and mind you, Mr. Chairman, we were talking with the mid-level bureaucracy at CMS, and we'd ask them a question that was at all, we're pushing the envelope. They said we'd have to get back to you on that. We were not talking with the people that have the authority to make a decision. And so you really can't rely on them, because the experience has been other states, and I cite Indiana as the most recent example, have gotten things out of CMS that nobody thought was possible. You present them with this under the current circumstances in Washington, I think there's a very good chance they will approve it. And, Mr. Chairman, come back to the need for this. They ought to approve it, because having an incentive in to control the utilization and control the costs is first going to reduce the cost to the federal government. And we're all going to pay the price for the way the federal government is financing its programs and its deficit. And second, by reducing emergency room use, by reducing the number of extra tests and whatnot that people get, all those things, you are going to improve the health of the participants involved. And, Mr. Chairman, I like to think that's important to the feds, too.
Senator Nicholas.
And I want to, I'm going to give you maybe three topics to talk so we can move this along, but with respect to the last item that you spoke to, I understand then the objective of the amendment is to provide incentives for use and to decrease use. Would not, if we had, we're building our system, we want to encourage folks to begin to use primary care doctors on an annual basis, health care checks, and doing things that will prevent them from needing to go to emergent care? And if so, how does the copay system, if you're promoting non-use, that's as bad as promoting overuse to the wrong places. And it, of course, assumes that folks can get that care. So I'm not prepared to accept your proposition on face value that the HSA, based upon virtual money, where virtual dollars are credited against you, that your incentive is for non-use. In fact, I'm not sure that I'm prepared to accept that on face value, but I understand it. I think the argument, but if you're promoting non-use, don't we actually create another unintended consequence? One thing that I would also ask you about is this sheet with respect to premiums. And I'm not sure if those are monthly or annual premiums, but in general, I believe this to be the case from my own experience working with the Medicaid, is that if I go to my office situation, if I elect to have pregnancy coverage, my premiums go up significantly, $300 or $400 a month for every employee in my entire business. In our case, we live in a community where we hire lots of young people that are going to the university, and they're at an age where we have chosen to pay higher premiums because we, if we have young women working for us, we want them to be able to pay for their delivery costs. I believe that the current Medicaid system is generally designed for young women who, in fact, are most likely either pregnant or going to be delivering. So what we've done is we've taken probably the most expensive population and put them into Medicaid. I also believe that from experience is that about 50% of all deliveries in the state are paid for by the Medicaid system and maybe higher. And that's partly because employers can choose to have delivery charges. And so it's an election that you, at least I'm not sure on the current Obamacare, but at least it was the case. So if you go back to data and you take the Medicaid cost and you compare those to insurance costs, you're comparing to a bunch of insured folks that don't even provide at that time coverage for pregnancy. And you're also, and even if you did, if all those employers had those coverage, they're all insuring in that group folks that will never have children, they're men. So I would expect that the Medicaid program would be more expensive right now because that's the population that's primarily receiving benefits. So to say that, so I'm unpersuaded that taking the Medicaid cost, which is primarily covering young pregnant, or let's say, young pregnant women, and paying for deliveries, has anything to do with or should be compared to the general population, which may or may not have pregnancy coverage. And even if they do, at most it's probably going to be a small percentage of their workforce that you expect to be utilizing those benefits.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me see if I can explain. First, on the using the copayment system to discourage utilization. You've got, and this will be in common, the share plan or the plan with this amendment. The Medicaid requires a whole series of wellness measures. Those will be outside the copayment system. That's just a common given right across this. And it includes taking care of the pregnancy cost. That's one of the essential benefits. You've got to offer that. So this will. And the share plan will too. Those are things that are going to be in common between the two plans. So they're not affected by this amendment. With regard to, does that distort the figures here as to how much more expensive Medicaid it is? It may or it may not, Mr. Chairman. You got an offsetting problem the other way. The Medicaid population, adult population currently, is relatively young. Yes, it has the expense of the pregnancy and deliveries in it, but it typically does not have much of the chronic disease things that all the rest of us get when we get older. That'll come in too. So there's an argument there. That's why it's important to look at children are not that much affected by this, but look at what the Medicaid cost has done in the children. You see the same kind of phenomenon. It's a much more expensive program. And those figures, I think, are entirely comparable. I don't think there's a problem there. So, Mr. Chairman, and that confirms what I see with Medicaid all over the country. It is a very expensive program, and it will eat your financial lunch as a state. And it's not healthy for the people. That's why we need this or some other really meaningful and effective cost control.
Any further discussion?
Question.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 129, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
That amendment is passed. Division call. Have a standing roll call.
No.
No? No. Standing vote, excuse me. Oh, those in favor, please say aye. Huh? Please stand. Those opposed, please stand. The Boston to adopt Standing Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 129 has failed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Oh, excuse me, Senator Scott.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, yield to Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again.
You've heard the motion. I'll say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
You've got a committee meeting.
Motion carried.
Go ahead. Bill, go ahead.
Do we have any messages from the House or committee? Messages from the House.
January the 30th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 45, Healthcare Sharing Ministry, ayes 60. House Bill number 127, Termination of Employment Wages, ayes 60. And House Bill number 151, Governmental Immunity Waiver for Hospital Employees, ayes 60. January the 30th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message, third reading, passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 10, Education State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement, ayes 60. House Bill number 27, NRC Agreement State Authorization, ayes 58, noes 2. House Bill number 54, Corrective Action Account Distribution, ayes 60. House Bill number 93, Public Service Commission Authority, ayes 60. House Bill number 123, Juvenile Records Expungement, ayes 60. House Bill number 132, Juvenile Confidentiality in Court Proceedings, ayes 54, noes 6. House Bill number 53, Minerals to Value Added Product Facility Fund Program Substitute 1, ayes 40, noes 20. And House Bill number 122, Tribal License Plates, ayes 53, No 7, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
We have standing committee reports.
January the 30th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 102, Medical Billing Provisional Providers, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Before we take the motion, I think we have a request before the motion is made to recess. Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd ask for a couple of bill redirections. I would request that Senate File 121, Career and Technical Training Grants, introduced by Senator Hastert, be re-referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. I would further request that Senate File 118, Personal Opportunity with Employment Responsibilities, introduced by Senator Kraft, be referred to Senate Committee Number 10, Labor.
Without objection, Senate File 121 is re-referred to Committee Number 9 as the first committee, and Senate File 118 is re-referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, for its first committee. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that does clear the desk.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. And Mr. President, before I make the motion, we have a committee that I know there's some people waiting to testify, and so we're going to take a little longer lunch to give the Minerals Committee time to try to do their work, because they've come a long ways, and I don't want to have them come down here and not be able to say what they want to say. So with that, Mr. President, I would move the recess until 2:15.
Are there any announcements? Senator Von Fladern.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 9, Minerals and Economic Development, will meet at 20 past the hour, 1:20. Please be in a new room. It's 302. Minerals will meet in room 302. Please note that, and we'll try to get at least that first bill. Senate File 123, Collective Bargaining for Firefighters. Senate File 125, Incineration Permitting Location, may not make it. Senate File 130, Lottery Commission Reporting Requirements, will not make it today, but we'll move them to Monday.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Judiciary Committee, number one, will meet Monday, February 2nd, 8 a.m. in room S1 to consider the following bill. Senate File 115, Discrimination.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet Monday, February 2nd, upon adjournment in room S14 to continue work on Senate File 95, Speed Limits. We'll hear Senate File 137, Farm License Plates, and Senate File 127, Transportation and Education Revenue Distribution.
Thank you, Mr. President. Committee number 7, Corporations, will continue our kind of working sessions Monday upon a noon recess and later upon final adjournment. We'll be just considering, it's a working group on Senate File 43, Wyoming Telecommunications Act Revisions, Senate File 140, Wyoming Telecommunications Act Rewrite. There'll be no votes or actions taken.
Any further announcements? There being none, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate will stand adjourned until 2:15, or stand recess until 2:15.